which floated the images of my past, my sons, Ira, the hut where we lived and the fields we had worked. The more I banished them, the faster they came. I saw old Granny again, toothless and wrinkled, Kenny, his eyes sorrowful when I told him we were going, Sakrabani's face, white and scared as it often was. I tried and tried, concentrating on the prayers that were being said, and at last the images faded. I saw in their place the countenance of the god and his consort, and it seemed to me that they looked on me benignly, and I was at length able to pray. All about me was a deep, intense silence, and in it I heard my prayer, voiceless, wordless, rising up and endlessly like the incense which burnt perpetually upon the altar. And when at last I opened my eyes, the silence which had enfolded me had given place to a pervasive murmur, the sound from the suppliant lips and beseeching throats of the multitude. A drum struck savagely through the hush, sent it shivering, flying. People blinked and stared, called thus rudely to take up their ordinary existence. One of the priests began to sprinkle holy water, people maneuvering to get near the precious drops. The other was handing out the food to a third man, and as soon as this was done, the gilded doors of the inner chamber were closed. Almost at once, the people began moving to the courtyard, which opened from the assembly hall. "The food will be distributed here," a woman whispered to me. "There is not always enough to go around. It is best to be first." A lot of people had the same idea and were jockeying energetically for position. The murmuring silence gave. The crowd burst into loud chatter. It was as if the thought of food had loosened all tongues, and the pushing and thrusting became more violent. The friendliness that had existed before was gone. Men and women struggled to be in the forefront, fighting their way with ferocity, thrusting forward with strident urgency. I found myself in the middle of the throng. Nathan had got separated, and looking round, I saw him on the outward fringe, among the very old and crippled. He had never been one for pushing. "Well," I thought, I can tell them my husband is here and take two portions." Then I saw two men enter, bringing food, and all other thought ceased. Craning my neck and body, standing on tiptoe, I saw the cauldrons they carried, cauldrons of rice heaped high and showing white gleaming peaks from which wisps of steam issued, and pots filled with a mixture of dal and vegetables, which sent forth a most savory smell. From a pile beside him, one of the men took out a plantain leaf, not a whole one, but cut it into pieces, twice the size of a man's hand. On this, he ladled out two spoonfuls of rice, the other filled a small cup made from dried leaves held together with thorns, with the dal mixture. From the crush, one man at a time, as much by pressure as by his own efforts, was ejected. Like the palm leaf stopper of a foaming toddy pot, collected his portion, drank of the holy water, and made his way out. My turn came. The level of rice was already fallen so low that it was only going by close to the vessel that I could see any rice at all. One of the men rebuked me sharply. "Keep your distance. Do you want to devour pot and all?" I must ask for my husband, I thought, and found myself quaking. The plantain leaf was handed to me, the rice placed on top, then the cup of dal. "Now, if you would be so kind, sir," I said, "I will take my husband's portion as well on my leaf." They gaped at me, surprised, affronted. "The woman is mad," one called out. "Expects a double portion?" "Not satisfied with one," the other rejoined in an offended voice, "but must try and make capital out of charity." "I do not. I have a husband. He is here. I ask only for his portion. If he is here, let him come and we will serve him in his turn. We cannot hand out food to everyone merely because they ask for it. Do you take us for fools? Keep your tails to the unwary," cried one, and the other one called out impatiently. "Hurry up, hurry up. Do you want to keep us standing here all night?" I went, taking my food with me. Those who had been served were sitting in the open a little way off eating, and I joined them. Perhaps I looked dejected, for one of the women said consolingly, "They were sharp-tongued tonight. Probably they were tired. You must not mind." There was a murmur of assent. except from a man who had said in a hostile voice, "Well, they are right. Everyone must come in his turn, or who is to know the truth from a lie when people ask for more than one portion?" And again, from the easily swayed crowd came a murmur of agreement. "I must justify myself in the eyes of these people," I thought forlornly, and I said, "I spoke the truth. My husband is here. See, he is coming to me," as I saw him approach. I also saw that his hands were empty. Still, it was good to share what there was and eat. Good to have food in the belly. Good to feel the dizziness replaced by well-being. When we had finished, we threw the empty leaves to the goats that had gathered, expectant but patient for their meal. And that was too a satisfying thing. To see them eating leaves in cups, crunching them in their mouths with soft, happy movements, and looking at us with their mild, benign eyes. Then we went and washed out our hands under the running tap, rinsing mouth and face as well in the cool water, and came back ready for sleep. It was only then that we remembered with trepidation our bundles. We had left them propped against one of the carved stone pillars in the long corridor leading to the assembly hall. We went to it, but the bundles had vanished. Perhaps our memory is at fault. Maybe it is not this particular stone pillar, but another. There are so many, and one is like another, I thought. To the next, and the next, and the next, and the next. There were hundreds of pillars and column, and we went to them all with fast dying hope. Three or four had seen us searching. Three or four more joined these. Soon a small crowd of advisors and helpers followed us at our heels. "Are you sure it was this hall of pillars? There is another one on the west side of the temple." "Quite sure. We have not been on the other side." "How could they?" said a scornful voice. "That side is locked at night." "Who was looking after the bundles?" "No one, no one. We left them unattended." "Unattended? Looking for trouble, that was. There are so many thieves and strangers about these days." "What, even in a temple? We did not think." "Yes, even in a temple, of course. Many kids come here. There can be no guarantee of their honesty." "It appears not," Nathan said heavily. "Our possessions have gone." There was futility only in further searching, further weariness. We gave up and leant our backs against the painted wall which encircled the temple, the vermilion and white striped wall we had foolishly thought meant safety. The promise of shelter had been kept, however, food and somewhere to sleep. "At least the loss is not irreparable," Nathan said. "We have our money still. The pots and matting can be replaced." "Best not to speak of it," I said, feeling cautiously for the money in my waistband, the coins hard and comforting to my touch. "We must be careful." He smiled wryly. "After the horse was bolted?" But I could not smile, and the ease with which he accepted the misfortune irritated me. "Now I shall be wholly indebted to my daughter-in-law," I thought. "I go to her without even a cooking vessel, like any beggar off the streets." And straightway I determined to spend one or two of the coins I felt digging into my flesh at the nearest bazaar, for I would not go to her destitute. Soothed a little by the thought, I drifted into sleep, broke often by bells ringing and the low rat-tat of drums for the prayers which went on at intervals throughout the night. Once in my half-sleep, it seemed to me someone was tugging at my arm, but when I awoke, it was only Nathan clutching at me in his sleep. I dozed off again, and after a while, I felt a soft fumbling about my face, noiseless, like fingers on spindle cotton. I strove to wake, to brush aside those pathetic flutterings, but strive as I would, I could not. At last, I sat up. Sleep and dream alike vanished. Wide awake now. And whether from the fact of sleeping in new surroundings or from the loss we had sustained, I was unable to sleep again. I leant against that same wall by which we had laid ourselves down, watching the wind play with the yellow flare on the top of the temple, looking into the darkness which varied its pitch from point to point. Gradually, I was able to make out the forms of the carven gods and goddesses on sides of the temple, on the colonnades, and in the niches of the walls, and as I gazed, they seemed to almost live, their stone breasts gently breathing, their limbs slightly moving. Nearly could I believe what I saw, sitting there in the darkness by the temple wall. Until dawn, when the stars went out one by one, and the gray light changed the sculptured figures back into immobility. Chapter 25. As always, Nathan stirred with the first light. When he saw I was awake, he sat up quickly, rubbing the sleep from his eyes. "You slept well," I said, a little nervous because I had not, yet glad since he looked so much better for it. "Yes, I was tired, but you look as if you have been up all night." "Almost. I could not sleep." "You were worried, no doubt," he said gravely, and the concern in his voice made me slightly ashamed of myself. "Still, we shall soon be with our son, and you will be able to rest. Come, we may as well start now. The sooner the better." We went to wash at the tap, threading our way among the heap of rags under which men and women lay huddled in sleep, their crutches or staffs and begging bowls beside them. And when we had done, we went out the way we had come in. Early though it was, many of the shops were open. From the food stalls came the sputtering of ghee and oil as bread and pancakes were fried, ready for the early worshippers who would soon be coming. As we passed, Nathan hesitated, and I saw him eyeing the crisp golden pancakes laid out on a platter. "Let us buy a few," he said cheerfully. "I am hungry enough, and you must be too." I, for my part, hesitated, although the food was tempting enough, for the silver coins we had were few and precious, and there was no telling what our needs might still be. Still, I could not very well deny him when I had already made up my mind to spend some of the money on cooking vessels, and so I put my hand in my waistband to take out the money I had tied there. The coins were gone. I felt in my bodice and again in my waistband. I shook out the folds of my sari, but there was no doubt the money was gone. "It may have slipped out in the night," Nathan said, and we went back, unhopeful, to where we had slept, but the ground was bare and innocent. And those who saw us entering again laughed and said free meals were only given in the evening, not in the morning. Their laughter changed to concern when we explained what had befallen us. But their concern was only perfunctory, since they were all after lookers-on and not partakers. And I noticed one or two glances exchanged, pitying yet scornful, which said as plainly as words, "These are simple, careless country folk." Lost and bewildered, although I was, I could contain myself no longer, and I said sharply, "There was not too little care, but too many thieves," and saw them nodding in a facile agreement. Yes, thieves and pickpockets were very skillful. One needed to exercise the utmost care. Well, we had not, and so we went our way with nothing to call our own save for what we wore, past the food stall with set, steadfast pace, past the bazaar with never a glance, pressing on to reach the shelter of our son's house before worse could overtake us. Through the streets of the terrifying city, amid the unaccustomed traffic and crowds, screwing up our courage each time we asked our way, we went along slowly. Some we questioned would not stop to answer. Others did not know. Many, in trying to be helpful, directed us wrongly. Without exception, they were all confusing, or we were dull. There were so many turnings we were to take, so many not to, that by the time we had followed the instruction to about the third turning, we were completely lost and had to stop and ask again. "I am a little slow," Nathan said humbly. "They speak so fast I can hardly follow, and I cannot remember all they say." "If you are, so am I," I said stoutly, "for I also find it difficult." It being midday, we sat down to rest by the roadside. A dozen or more children were playing there, dodging in and out of the traffic with a skill and indifference which I could not help admiring. For all their play, they looked as if they had never eaten a full meal in their lives, with their ribs thrust out and their bellies full blown like drums with wind and emptiness. And they were also extremely dirty, with the dust of the roadside and the filth deposited upon it. And the running sores many of them had upon their bodies were clogged with mud, where blood or pus had exuded. But they themselves were forgetful of their pains, or patient with them, as the bullock had been, and played naked and merry in the sun. Mary, that is, until a crust of bread fell on the road or a sweetmeat toppled from an overambitious pyramid, when all childish lost, all play forgotten, they fought ferociously in the dust for the food. My children had fought thus too, I remembered. But time had mellowed the memory, or dimmed it, for it did not seem to me that they had all struggled like these. Teeth bared, nails clawing ready, predatory like animals. But when a man of wealth passed, they were as tender and pitiful as fledglings, beseeching with soft open mouths and limpid eyes, their begging bowls meekly held before them, and altogether changed with an artfulness which surely my children had not at their command. And however much they played and were children, still their faces were scored with the knowledge and cares that children should not have. Their eyes were knowing and guileful beyond their years. We may yet be forced to do that, said Nathan, pointing to their begging bowls, if we do not find our son. Never, I protested, a little frightened by his dejection. Come, we must be on our way. Let us ask these children, he said. They seem quick. He clicked his fingers and called, and they came with curious bright eyes, twittering like sparrows. Tell me, my son, do you know where Coyle Street is? Coyle Street? There are three or four. Which one do you seek? Three or four, Nathan exclaimed. No wonder we have been chasing our tails. If you tell me the name of the people, a boy said, there are a few I do not know. That I can well believe. We are looking for my son, who is named Murugan, and he works with one Birla, who is a doctor. I do not know of Murugan, the boy said frankly, but everyone knows Birla. For a small sum, he added, I will take you there myself. I have less than you, Nathan sighed. I can give you nothing. Oh, the boy said, disappointed, his voice falling away. Then an idea seemed to strike him, and he said shrewdly, Yet I myself will take you there, and if you prosper, you can pay me. And how shall I know you? I am called Puli, after the king of animals, and I am leader of our pack. I am well known as Birla. Then I shall know where to find you, Nathan said, smiling, for there was an impudence of the boy which was somehow attractive. Lead on, my young friend. The boy turned and said something to his companions, and there was no doubt that he was their leader, for they dispersed at once. Then he beckoned to us. Follow closely, he said firmly. This child, who might easily have been our grandson, or you will be lost. And he motioned us forward. And as he did, so I saw that he had no fingers but only stumps. The disease which was rotting away his body had eaten away nail and flesh to the first knuckle. Prudently, we took his advice to follow closely, although he went at a pace which we found difficult to match. And presently he brought us to a small whitewashed house set in the street on a corner of which stood at church. This is the street, this is the church, this is the house, he said rapidly pointing, and at once turned and made off, his head down and his shoulders moving as he ran. We stood and looked at the house, arrived but uncertain how to proceed, and it looked back at us neither inviting nor forbidding. There was a wooden paling around it, broken by a small wooden gate, and at length, there being nobody in sight to ask, we walked through to the garden and so to the house. The doors and windows in it were wide open as if the occupants needed all the fresh air there was, and we could see right to the back of the house where two or three men were sitting wearing the white tunics of servants. And one of them at length saw us and came forward, saying mechanically, as if he had used the same words many times before, Beggars are not allowed here, only those who need. Then seeing we neither carried begging bowls nor held out our hands for alms, he stopped short. What have you come for? Our son works here, Nathan said. His name is Murugan.
Murugan? No one of that name works here.
Doesn't work here, are you sure?
Of course I am sure. There are only three servants employed, and Murugan is not one of them.
There must be some mistake, Nathan muttered. He pulled out the slip of paper on which the address was written and handed it to the man.